Attorney Michael Krinsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. You've been representing the Cuban government for many, many years, and you happened to be down there 2 weeks ago when the news came out. What was it like?
It was an extraordinary moment. Word got around that President Raul Castro was going to talk to the Cuban people on television at noon. So everyone ran to find a television, including me, to see what
you had no idea.
Say. Well, I had some idea.
He is the attorney for Cuba, Michael. I mean, it's not like you and I were sitting here.
Yeah.
But I think generally speaking, most people were surprised at the extent to which Obama went in saying he was going to seek normalization of relations. I think many people, anyway, had expected President Obama to take some minor measures, perhaps as to test the waters, perhaps to get things moving. But I think most people were really quite surprised at the tone of his speech and what he said. The reaction was palpable. I mean, I happened to be at a conference of U.S. and Cuban scholars, which were talking about the U.S.-Cuban relations, and that's where I saw President Castro give his speech. First thing he said, well, of course, was the Cuban heroes, the three of the remaining Cuban five, were home. And the place broke into pandemonium, and people jumped up and literally hugging each other. People were crying. Then they quieted down and they listened to the next thing. And then when he said, President Obama and I have agreed to reestablish normal diplomatic relations, there was silence, stunned silence. And then people, you know, half a second later, absorbed what they had just heard. And again, there was a tremendous commotion. People felt a sense of, I think, of triumph. The person on the street, people on the street who I spoke to, people in the government, I think felt a genuine sense of triumph that after 55 years of holding on despite Bay of Pigs, despite blockade, economic blockade, despite the special period when the trade with the Soviet Union collapsed, they had held on. And in the end, as someone put it, the United States came to us. And so there was a tremendous sense of vindication and of triumph. You could see it on the street. You could see it in the restaurants. You could see it in the offices. People were happy. They were smiling. They were literally smiling for days afterwards. And they would go and they would congratulate each other. Like, we did it. We did it. So it was quite a moment.
Now, Michael, when you talked about, this is Michael Ratner speaking, when you talked about Raul's speech, and I read it right afterwards, and I was amazed by it because of the way it started with the Cuban Five, then went to diplomatic relations, and then went to the embargo, was the third point. On the embargo, he essentially, somewhat, I wouldn't say differed from Obama. He said there still remains a lot to be done, and Obama can do a lot more. So talk a little bit about the embargo, what it's meant for Cuba, and what can be done now.
Well, the embargo has been in effect for essentially 54 years. It is as comprehensive an economic embargo as this country has ever imposed and perhaps any country has ever imposed against any country. And it's not simply the U.S. saying, we, the United States, won't trade with Cuba. A major part of it is its extraterritorial reach, its effort to make trade between Cuba and third countries difficult and impossible where they can go that far, and has a tremendous impact on the Cuban economy and has for 50 years. They can't get U.S. Parts for their equipment, for their machinery. They cannot use U.S. dollars in international transactions, even when the transactions don't involve the United States, they can't use U.S. dollars, which is the currency of international trade. Shipping to Cuba is made extremely difficult because of the U.S. law that says if you trade with Cuba, if a ship goes to Cuba, it can't come to the United States for 6 months. And that, so that distorts trading patterns, shipping patterns. Everyone in Cuba lives on a daily basis with what they, I think, rightfully call a blockade, not just an embargo, which implies just bilateral trade. A blockade implies an effort to interrupt, disrupt trade between the United States, Cuba, and a third country. Everyone lives with it. People would, this week, when the prior week when I was down there, would say, come up to me and they say, I have lived my entire life under the blockade. And now perhaps, and I thought maybe my children or grandchildren would see the end of it, but now perhaps I will see the end of it. But Raul's point is, I think, a very important one, which is it's far from over. The steps that Obama announced are very small, very discreet steps in very specific areas. I mean, they're important. They're a good beginning, but they are very limited. For example, if you want an example, there is nothing there about Cuban products being sold in the United States.
It's all one way, really.
It's all one way. And yeah, Cubans have, you know, people are surprised to find this, Cubans have developed a lot of medical products, innovative medical products that some doctors are very excited about. They can't come into the United States. And, of course, you know, all the famous Cuban products of rum and cigars and so forth. So that's all, what he said was all one way at the moment. So he hasn't even begun that part of the dismantling of the blockade. Even on travel, which, you know, he talked about it opening up travel more. There was nothing in the announcements about regular air service, regular airplane service between the two countries. If there's going to really be an opening of travel between the United States and Cuba, there has to be regular air service. People just can't get there from here unless there's regular air service, not in the kind of volume that Obama is talking about.
And you still need to fit into a certain category for travel, right?
And you need to fit within 12 specific categories. Travel, ironically, is the one significant area where Congress has limited the president's executive authority.
In other words, in other areas, the president can do pretty much what he wants under the embargo. He can open it up quite a bit.
Yeah. The president has retained, despite all the legislation passed by Congress, has retained the licensing authority, the authority to license categories of transactions or specific transactions. He can't deregulate relations with Cuba. He can't say you don't need a license. But he can grant the licenses and in very, very broad categories. You know, President Carter granted, before legislation limiting travel, President Carter opened up travel completely by a license.
I remember. I was on a flight from New York, AeroAir. It was a CIA proprietary, I think. And we flew directly from Orange County down to Havana. I couldn't believe it. After spending years of my life, this is Michael Ratner, going through Mexico City or Jamaica or Canada. I drove upstate. I got on a plane.
Exactly.
And there I was.
Exactly.
But it's only 6 weeks, though, it lasted or something, 6 months. Very short time.
Yeah. It lasted. Yeah. And then there were alternative relations, and they started cutting back on it. Even on travel, Obama is limited to 12 categories. One of those categories in particular is a broad category, people-to-people contact. But even there, we don't know how broad he's going to open it up. Can individuals go themselves, or do they still have to go through under the auspices of some organization in the United States? Do they have to have a preset programmed activity, or can they go and wander around meeting people? These are questions that are not have not been answered in anything I've seen.
But in the end, really, what you're saying is, but in the travel area, which might be a little narrower, the president has the authority to license almost everything every economic transaction with Cuba at this point.
Right, right. Export, import, financial transactions, loans, credits, investment, all of these things are within the president's licensing authority. And how far he will go in 2 years, you know, remains to be seen.
Right. Let me ask a background question on that is, you know, all the time we read, well, Cuba, you know, in 1959, 1960, 1961, started nationalizing U.S. property, et cetera. And that's why the embargo was imposed. Can you give us a little, I think there's a more nuanced history to this.
Yeah, actually, it's really quite quite different, the real history. And, you know, historians have written about it. But if you get into the State Department documents, and they've published a fair amount over the years because enough time had passed, you know, the picture is really quite different. The nationalizations was, you know, part of the story, but it was a minor part of the story. The United States did not want a left-wing socialist revolution to succeed in the Americas. You know, I was looking at the documents published by the State Department about the severance of diplomatic relations. They were planning it for months before they actually severed diplomatic relations in January 1961. And the nationalization of U.S. property is barely mentioned in all these documents. It's all about the socialist character of the Cuban Revolution. According to them, its efforts and about Cuban foreign policy, its efforts to promote and support leftist movements in other countries in Latin America, and its increasing alliance with the Soviet Union. That was the theme both publicly and internally in the U.S. government until about 1991, 1992. And then there was a shift. And then for the first time, the United States publicly started talking about the purpose, the goal of U.S. policy, including the blockade, was to change the internal character of the Cuban system, the Cuban government. Civil liberties, multi-party, free elections, free speech. Those became, for the first time, the articulated goals of U.S. policy. Before then, it was entirely different things. And of those different things, the nationalizations was a minor part. After all, you know, there have been nationalizations. Many countries have nationalized property. You know, after a while, after many years usually, it's resolved in one fashion or another. It was never the driving force.
Right. In fact, a lot of the embargo really was increased after the Bay of Pigs invasion, right, in the 61
invasion.
Yeah,
It was really not really in full force until they did not invoke the Trading with the Enemy Act, which is the main source of the sweeping character of the embargo, until 1963.
Let me step back and ask you about your firm's involvement and your involvement with Cuba, which goes back many, many years. You, of course, are a partner with the famous law firm Rabinowitz, Boudin, Standard, Krinsky, Lieberman, and now I understand you have a new partner in the firm. How did your firm get involved representing the government of Cuba, and then how did you get involved?
Well, the firm's history with Cuba, I'm told, since I was not there at the beginning, came out of the fact that during the 50s, during the McCarthy period, the firm had represented many intellectuals, writers, scholars, activists who had come under attack by McCarthy himself, UAC, loyalty oaths, and so forth. Cuban Revolution takes place. And some of these people go down to Cuba, some of these U.S. people that the firm had represented goes down to Cuba and study it, write about it, and in a few cases actually became advisors to the new government. And at a certain point, the Cuban government, I'm told, said, you know, we're gonna need some U.S. lawyers. There's probably going to be some trouble. And so these folks who knew the firm said, well, you know, there's Victor Rabinowitz, Leonard Boudin in New York. They're really good lawyers. You should speak to them. So that's how that began. And the firm was retained in September 1960. I came to the firm in 1970, not because of that work, but because of all the work, anti-war work he was doing. But then I got there, and I had never even taken a course in international law in law school. I said, why would one want to know something like that? I mean, how irrelevant can you get? But I came, and I found that the international work of the firm's representation of Cuba, and for a time, Allende's Chile, found it very, very compelling. You know, I was told the embargo was going to be over soon, but, you know, I should learn something about it, and that was, you know, a couple of years ago.
All the Cubans who left Cuba thought they were coming back in a few months to reclaim whatever they left, but anyway,
didn't happen. We do represent a fair number of U.S. organizations, individuals, businesses that have to contend with the embargo. And, you know, I'm just speaking here as a lawyer who knows something about this area, not on behalf of any of our clients. So that's how I got involved. The telephone conversation between the two presidents was hopefully a real turning point.
Yeah, let's hope so. But let me ask about a couple of things that have come up in the wake of it. One is Guantanamo, the U.S. military base in Cuba, not just the current iteration of it, which is where it's keeping prisoners, but the question of whether it'll ever be returned to Cuba. Can you tell us why it's there altogether, and then is that coming up at all? Is that going to be an issue when they go down the line?
Well, you know, it wasn't mentioned in any of these that I saw in any of these public statements by either government. It's been there since basically the Spanish-American War. The United States was supposedly supposed to be just a naval station for coaling. You know, ships operated on coal then. That's why it was established, and there was a 99-year lease between a captive Cuban government and the United States. And then it was changed to in perpetuity. I think everyone assumes that at some point this land, this part of Cuba's sovereign land, will be returned to sovereign control by the United States. But that is something that I would not expect that to be early on the agenda of discussions.
And another issue that's come up all along, and I don't know if you have any knowledge about it, of course, is with people who've taken asylum in Cuba.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think you would know what that is. I know there's a number of people who have, and people want to know, are they coming back? What's happening? And
I don't know.
I mean, the Cubans have made a statement that they're not.
Josefina Vidal, who's the head of the U.S. desk at the Cuban Foreign Ministry, I saw made his statement yesterday that Cuba maintains its right to grant political asylum. Like every other country has a right to grant political asylum. But beyond that, I'm not aware of anything.
So how are you feeling about your work right now, Michael? Feeling you've been at it, I mean, since you and I became lawyers around the same year, 1970, and, you know, I've followed you obviously forever and worked with you on a number of cases, but so it's only been 44 years of work.
I think, like a lot of people, in Cuba, I mean, I'm trying to find the right balance between a great deal of enthusiasm and excitement and not necessarily skepticism, but caution. There's a long way to go before things have really changed. Obama's statement that the United States is going to seek normalization, and his statement that we are going to establish normal diplomatic relations, I think is, you know, a very significant change. The U.S. policy for the preceding 50-odd years has been to try to go around the Cuban government to the Cuban people. That's the most benign way of putting it. I mean, it was blockade, invasion, sabotage. And then, you know, as all of that failed, the administrations, every prior administration, I must say, with more or less nuance, have pursued a policy of trying to go around the Cuban government to what they thought was the Cuban people, who they kind of always have misread with the Cuban people stand. But not to make it simple, but they've always misread it. Here, it was not saying that. It was saying, we're going to deal with the Cuban government. We recognize this government not only in a strict legal sense, but we recognize it in terms of a diplomatic sense of being a sovereign, an equal sovereign, a government that we're going to deal with and that we're going to negotiate with. For people who don't quite know the history, that is a remarkable change. It's a remarkable change when the photograph that the White House chooses to put on its website to announce this is a photograph of President Obama on the telephone speaking with President Castro.
Amazing.
And that is a very, very powerful statement of a shift in attitude. The document, the State Department documents making the final recommendation to sever diplomatic relations said, why do we want to sever diplomatic relations? Is because one of the first reasons they list is that we want to signal to the Cuban people that we do not consider this government legitimate or permanent.
Wow.
And so so now the establishing diplomatic relations, you know, implies the exact opposite. It's legitimate, it's permanent, and there will be negotiations, government-to-government negotiations. So it's a big change. It's a big change.
Rabinowitz and Boudin brought a fair number of cases around Cuba and the embargo, and one of them you argued, I think, a banking case in the Supreme Court. One was called Wald v. Reagan, which was an embargo challenge, and the other is Sabatino. Let's start with the earliest, which is Sabatino, and just because it's relevant to property, taking of property. And that was the case that essentially said the United States isn't going to interfere in it. But why don't you just tell us what that is.
The Sabatino case.
The Supreme Court case,
yes, Sabatino. The United States Supreme Court in 1964 decided a case called Banco Nacional de Cuba versus Sabatino. And at that point, Cuba had nationalized essentially all major U.S.-owned property in Cuba, the U.S. corporations. I mean, there are a great number of companies, U.S. companies whose property have been nationalized. But in truth, most of the value was very concentrated. The top 30 companies account for something like 80% of all nationalized property. The top 10 account for almost 50%. And so these companies, many of these companies brought lawsuits in the United States against Cuba to get judgments to seize whatever assets were still around. And they had succeeded, and the lower courts had given judgments and said the Cuban nationalizations were in violation of international law. Supreme Court said something different. It said the courts of the United States should not pass judgment on the legality of the acts of a foreign sovereign, in this case Cuba, done within its own territory. The property was in Cuba. Cuba is a sovereign state. We, the courts, will not determine the legality of those nationalizations. And underlying that, it said, look, the United States goes around and says nationalizations must be accompanied by full compensation. But the Supreme Court said, and this is one of the things that really got me interested in the international law work at the firm when I read this decision. It said, you know, that's what the United States goes around and says. But there are a lot of countries in the world that say something else. And there is actually, in truth, a great division of opinion, international opinion between countries on this question. and the Supreme Court put it somewhat euphemistically, the division really is between the capital exporting and the capital importing countries. Really, we would say, you know, between the Western United States and the Third World. That's the division.
Capital exporting countries. They like to
Full compensation.
Yeah, exactly.
Which most people pointed out, full compensation means no nationalization, because these countries aren't rich enough to pay full compensation. That's why they nationalized. Later on, because of some procedural peculiarities, there was a case which actually decided whether international law requires the payment of full compensation. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit here in New York, in a case involving Banco Nacional and Chase Manhattan Bank, said no. It does. If it ever did, we're not sure international law ever required full compensation. But it surely doesn't now anymore, since the emergence of all these independent countries that used to be colonies.
Big victories for the
world. Big victories, and something which may be relevant in whatever discussions happen later on between the United States and Cuba on this.
By that you mean all of compensation for what's happened over the last 50 years.
I was glad to see the State Department in its made reference to this. You know, the United States has claims for the nationalization of the property of its companies in Cuba in the early days. Cuba has a claim, has articulated that it has much greater claims against the United States for this blockade and for acts of economic sabotage, in which people have died actually over the years. So there are claims on both sides that have been articulated publicly in the past. Reagan versus Wald was, and you participated in, Michael, the law firm represented U.S. people who wanted to travel to Cuba. It was our third challenge to the travel ban that went to the United States Supreme Court. It happened after Reagan had come into office. And the Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to second-guess the executive. Yes, you have a constitutional right to travel, but the executive says there are foreign policy considerations, national security considerations that outweigh your constitutional right to travel. We're terribly sorry, but you that right won't prevail. And what were the reasons the United States articulated? There were three. One is Cuba supports armed insurrections in Latin America. Second, with Cuba has troops in Africa in positions contrary to U.S. interests. And third, Cuba has this strategic alliance with the Soviet Union, which is in a hostile relationship with the United States. And the Supreme Court said, we're not saying that those are real or weighty enough. We're just saying we, a court, cannot weigh them, cannot evaluate them against your constitutional right to travel. Terribly sorry. It was, the decision was 5-4.
Right, actually. I remember. It was really close.
It was really close. Okay. But after that, what happened, of course, is everyone acknowledges Cuba stopped sending arms or supporting its armed insurrections in the hemisphere. It no longer had troops in Africa. There was no longer a Soviet Union. And so everyone said, well, now we get our rights back, right? And the answer was no, we still don't give you your rights back. And we still don't have the constitutional right to travel. Through executive action, 12 categories of travel are authorized: professional research for professionals, structured educational programs, and so forth. And sometimes those are open, broader, and sometimes narrowed. We'll see what, in reality, President Obama does to open those channels now. But the full constitutional right of travel that every American enjoys to every other literally every other country in the world, still does not apply to Cuba. I think the next 2 years during President Obama's remaining term is we're going to see whether what has begun really will take hold and reach to the point where it's irreversible. It was a dramatic week. It was a turning point, we hope, but it still remains to be seen where it will end up.
And I know that one of the people, on a closing note, Michael, one of the people who was actually of counsel to your firm, Lenny Wineglass, who was, of course, died a couple of years ago, and a friend of all of ours, but he was the primary lawyer for the Cuban Five.
Absolutely.
And it's too bad he couldn't be here. And, of course, another member of your firm, Deborah Evanson, was lived in Cuba, did a lot of the work for your firm, and, of course, she died as well 2 years ago. It just tells you, of course, in some way, how long this embargo has been imposed on the Cuban people.
Yeah, we're talking about three generations of lawyers working on this.
Three generations too many.
And three generations of Cubans struggling with it.
You know? Yeah. Well, thank you, Michael, especially for sticking with it for 45 years. What can I say?
Okay. Good to see everyone.
Thank you so much.
Okay.